Okay, thanks again for joining us on Point for the latest podcast. Today we're joined by Anthony Smith, formerly a glass engineer, or still a glass engineer, but used to be with Arups, and I've known for many years, and now runs a very successful company called Interesting Projects in Glass. Welcome, Anthony.
Thank you, Rod. Now, obviously the name of the company is slightly wrong. The name of the company is IPIG, which stands for Inspiring Projects Involving Glass. You can find us at weareipig.com. Little plug there, but thank you.
Oh, there you go. So me and Anthony have, well, obviously we're both in a very similar industry, but I know you worked on Times Square. You did an art project there as well, wasn't it?
Well, we did a glass staircase in Times Square. It's the TKTS booth. I was involved in that probably 15 years ago now. That was one of the largest glass structures in the world, probably one of the largest publicly accessible glass structures in the world. People can walk all over it. It's 2,500 square feet of glass flooring, and it creates a raised piazza in Times Square. It's got the ticket booth underneath, and it creates a seating area in Times Square as well. So it's helped to regenerate that particular part of New York. That's probably one of the high points of the projects that I've worked on. I've been very privileged over the years to work on a very large number of structural glass projects. But that's one of the ones which is accessible to anybody to go and look at. Many of the projects we work on are for private individuals who wish to remain very, very private.
Where do you know, going forward, do you see a trend? What's our sort of biggest potential as an industry to grow and maybe do even more inspiring projects, not just with your own practice, but, you know, are you seeing some kind of flavour? You know, are we going back to brick? Are you values? Are the Kyoto Protocol, you know, it's meaning that we're going to use less glass? What's your flavour on that?
Some of the things that do seem to be perplexing, I suppose, design teams at the moment is this requirement for energy efficiency, this requirement for insulation, and yet the opportunity to reuse materials further down the line. We've seen a requirement for a building recently. It's a building where the aspirations of the design team are for a 50 to 100 year design life. And yet a lot of the technology and a lot of the materials that people are looking to incorporate into that have a very, very short lifespan. So, you know, you might get a warranty for some of the products that are being incorporated into these buildings. You might get a warranty of 2 years, of 5 years maybe. And I think if you look at some of the historic buildings in this country, if you look at some of the big country houses, they are, let's pick an example. You know, you might look at a big country house 100 years old, and that's still being used. It's still a very desirable residence. And I look back at maybe the car industry. You know, if you look back to cars that were made 100 years ago, or cars that were made 80 years ago, you know, there'll be a lot of vintage Rolls Royces and maybe vintage Daimlers and things like that around that are still going strong. Now, they're being very carefully maintained, but they're still usable. I wonder whether in 70, 80, 90 years' time, people will still be driving around in a 2020 model Tesla. And you compare that to some of the buildings at the moment, you know, as I said, a 100-year-old mansion or an 80-year-old big house that people are being able to refurbish, and they're being able to live in it, and they'll be able to update it, and they'll be able to modernize it. Some of the new builds that are being built at the moment, I struggle to see how these houses, which are made out of, OSB and blocks of polystyrene and a thin chemical render, things like that, I struggle to see how those will be being reused in 80, 90 years' time. And this the same, you know, when you incorporate glazing technology into these houses, the lifespan of insulated units is limited. It's getting better. It's getting better all the time. But you're still taking a piece of glass which should last hundreds of years and you're sticking it to another piece of glass, which should last hundreds of years, but the glue that you're using and the desiccant that you're using has got a finite lifespan. So we are responding to environmental requirements. We're responding to increased efficiencies in our buildings, but whether we're really responding to them with a very, very long-term and sustainable product, I think time will tell.
So that obviously that throws up an opportunity. So you're saying the potential is there to be sustainable. We've got quite a lot of materials, but the longevity. So there must be something that's created an opportunity somewhere in the industry for either a different way of living or a different expectation for buildings. So maybe, you know, is there an opportunity to say, well, okay, we're going to rebuild every 50 years, knowing that the materials are now more sustainable, reusable? Or is there a different opportunity?
I think the opportunity is reconfiguring those materials. For example, you know, if we were talking earlier about replacement of panels of glass on houses or on other projects, if you've got a large insulated unit which is manufactured out of laminated glass on the inside, maybe laminated glass on the outside, maybe it's got a super duper latest generation coating, environmental coating on the glass. There are isolated cases, and there are processes becoming available for recycling these materials. But when you think about how many thousands and thousands of square meters of product are going into the building industry every week at the moment, and you think about the scale of some of these recycling and reusing processes which are being developed at the moment, there is a massive disparity between the two. If you take the material and you really realize and really understand where the longevity of the material is, then the opportunity to reuse them and to incorporate them into buildings in a different manner, perhaps, it challenges the mindset, but to incorporate the materials in a more thoughtful way, I think that's where there's potential in the future.
Looking forward and trying to take some of those concepts forward, what would be the impact, you think, on society or even the landscape? Do you think there will be some greater impact than we're seeing?
I think we're always learning, and the type of scale of project, which there are lots of people coming up with different ideas. We looked at a project a few years ago whereby a private client had a modern house and his double glazed units had failed, and we started to get involved in the removal and replacement of these insulated units. And there was a proposal, and it came out of some former colleagues of mine at Arabs, to plumb all the units together and pump dried air around the from unit to unit to unit. Mm-hmm. To basically, rather than having sealed units, rather than having desiccant, and rather than having something which has a finite lifespan, but to create a plumbed and ventilated system. Now, that, as a retrofit, was an experimental idea, but something like that as a new build would mean that you would get around the reduced lifespan that you get out of some of these materials by just thinking about incorporating them into the building differently.
Do you see any particular needs out there in the marketplace? You know, I know at the moment there's shortages and high level of inflationary pressures, but do you see that there's any needs for change, whether it's legislation? I mean, we've obviously had a lot of impacts in the cladding industry over the last couple of years, but is there any other needs that you're seeing that need to be addressed?
The most impactful response, or the most impactful need, however you want to categorize it, would be in education. I think that there are a lot of people doing some really, really clever digital design. But my experience, and I would imagine you see the same issues in your own side of the industry, but the compatibility, the interfaces, the the way in which the materials are used, the way in which things are constructed, the sequence in which things are constructed, the collaboration between the parties involved, all of that probably stems from having a much more hands-on, much more vocational educational system for people coming into the industry. The capabilities for digital design have grown massively over the last 20 years. The ability to design shapes and forms and profiles and buildings and all manner of elements within the built environment, the ability to design those has come on incredibly. And I think my experience suggests this is the case, that when it comes to sites, when it comes to implementation, and when it comes to the management of that implementation on site, there are some very good people out there, but that is where most of the projects suffer most, is in the execution when it comes further down the supply chain. And I think that education should improve that.
Mm. Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned the technology piece, because I've really got excited about the whole BIM and how to, you know, how it's shaping and digital twins and things like that over the last couple of years. And yeah, as you said, the ability to design Hollywood's these days and the UK, when they're designing films, can have digitized whole sets to mortar detail, so you wouldn't be able to tell the difference whether you're on set or whether you're actually looking at a digital landscape. And certainly that's in going forward in architecture. I mean, we're starting to look at it with a view of having digital engineers, so guys can be in the field wearing headsets and be able to interpret DWGs or some kind of VAR type information. You've still got to have the guys in the field, have still got to be trained, still got to be experienced, still got to know what interfaces are going to be critical, you know, what missions they can make if they have to on site. And so I would agree with you there. I mean I've never really thought that it's almost like the skill level of the installer has to be upgraded even further from a tactile point of view. He almost needs to know many systems. You know, we've gone from unitized to stick systems to structural glass systems. And then you've got, you know, when you start talking about vented and double wall facades, you know, or, you know, you're talking about piped air in the units. I mean, the engineers in the field really are going to have to keep upskilling. And I think it's going to have to go hand in hand with technology. So, I mean, from a transformational point of view, how do you sort of see in 10 years' time, how would that even happen? What would that look like, that transformation of digital with actually in-field experience and in-field design?
I think there's two aspects to that. There is the digital side of it, but then there's the experience and there's the knowledge amongst the people who are doing it. You mentioned that, you know, that Hollywood can create fantastic virtual film sets and backdrops, and yes, there's a lot of technology involved in modelling buildings and in being able to create fly-throughs so that you can create digital architecture and you can sell the design of a project. But you and I both know that it's not the surface that you see that has the long-term issues and either makes or breaks the success of a building. It's everything that goes on behind that. So being able to create a three-dimensional image or a three-dimensional fly-through and down to the size of the mortar joints and things like that, yes, you might be able to sell that to your client, and they might then choose to go ahead with the building. But it's knowing the direction of the laps on the roof membranes. It's knowing to put in the right type of spacers. It's knowing to put in the right type of sealant. It's understanding that a particular membrane may not stick to a particular type of sealant, or knowing the type of adhesive to use, or there are so many small little details that go to make the success of a building, and that really comes down to the tradespeople, the specifiers, and the tradespeople understanding what is important and how to deal with it, and that really does come down to education.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Those as-builts and O&Ms are certainly the bane of my life, but I think if I was going to have a transformation piece, it would be to improve the way that we record and actually keep on file in a sort of national register, so that anyone can access it and anyone can diagnose. Because as we've been all working from home a bit more, it would be so great to actually be access those files from anywhere in the world and actually share it with people that are even more intelligent or have more experience with, you know, if I was looking at a glass staircase, to be able to share that file and actually spin it around and say, right, okay, well, this is how we installed it. These are some of the videos of what went on at the time. And then, you know, obviously pick your brain and say, well, what do you think? What do you think happened there? You know, and I think going forward, I think that's what I'd love to see is more of that.
Thing to bear in mind, though, is many people say you've got to follow the money and you've got to look at where is the value in that and who benefits from doing that. Because do the installation team, does the contractor who actually puts it together, does he benefit from that? The answer is probably not. So would he invest in that level of additional design, additional recording, additional documentation? Or is it something that needs to be instilled in the project team at a much earlier stage? Is it something that needs to be almost a project requirement, in which case then it's educating the clients, educating the design team leaders. Now there is there's obviously a planning supervisor role within construction these days, and there's the CDM regulations, and there is a very strong emphasis on good O&M manuals. But to go that one step further, as you've just suggested, you've got to understand where the value is and hence who's going to pay for it.
Mm. Well, yeah, I think accountability, you know, the accountability, and it might be, you know, it might be insurance. It might come from a left field area where they insist to have those, especially if you're signing up to, you know, like a 25-year design life, 30-year design life, then, you know, in 25 years' time, who knows where I'll be, but someone to go back and go, okay, well, I can clearly see what design philosophy, why they use these materials. Anthony, thanks for your time. I hope you listening really enjoyed that. I know I did. And hopefully we'll get to catch up again soon and maybe on another topic.